Ahoy there. Welcome to another edition of the FlixWise podcast. I'm your curmudgeonly captain, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is my drunken accordion-playing first mate, Gabe Haggard.
Gabe?
Hello.
And joining us today is a very special guest, local filmmaker, director of photography, and movie aficionado, Chris Knobloch.
Aye, matey, aye.
Perfect. All right.
I feel like that's more of a Scandinavian pirate as opposed to like a French barge sailor.
I don't know. I feel
aye,
like...
Aye, aye,
we...
Good.
On today's show, we're going to discuss the number 12 movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Jean Vigo's 1934 film, La Tolante. Obviously, La Tolante is considered by many to be a timeless masterpiece about love and life at sea. But will it float the FlixWise boat? You're about to find out. Then we're going to go from one confined space to another when we jump forward in time to review a semi-new release, the 2014 Tom Hardy vehicle, Locke. See what I did there? Vehicle. Huh? Pun definitely intended. As we're recording this podcast, Locke currently has an 88% on Rotten Tomatoes, but listen up to find out if it passes the FlixWise freshness test. All right, gentlemen. Begin. Are you ready? Life vests on.
One. Are we
two,
on the bar?
3, 4, 5, 6.
For our first topic, we're going to discuss Jean Vigo's 1934 French classic, La Tolante. La Tolante opens with a wedding between a young sailor named Jean, played by Jean d'Este. Hopefully that's how you say that. And a young country girl named Juliette, played by Dita Parlow. As soon as the nuptials are read, the two of them head off for a life of adventure and romance aboard the La Tolante, the titular boat that Jean captains through the waterways of France. However, the honeymoon doesn't last long, because they very quickly realize that married life comes with a unique set of challenges. For instance, Juliette wants to do laundry every so often, while apparently Jean couldn't care less if his sheets are smelly. Or when the La Tolante makes a stop in Paris, Juliette wants to go and check out the Eiffel Tower, and maybe have a baguette or two. But Jean doesn't want to make sightseeing a priority, choosing instead to stay aboard his boat and work. And while laundry might seem to be a fairly benign subject, it is representative of each character's respective outlooks on life. The film explores how this young couple goes about navigating the waters of the Seine, while also navigating the even more treacherous waters of a long-term romantic relationship.
That's a lot of weight to put on the shoulders of the laundry. I'm not sure if that's...
All right, guys, so what did you think of the movie? What were your first impressions? We'll start with Gabe.
I really enjoyed it. I think it's a great film. I think, like, the simplicity of it and the beauty of the cinematography, I thought, is incredible.
Chris, how about you?
I've seen this film a couple of times now, and I wasn't super crazy about the film at first. And then every time I see it, the film really grows in me. It's got this beautiful heart and soul to it. It's like this grim, dingy, industrial world they're in, and this woman is longing for something which she's not getting, and at the middle of it all is this like beautiful love story between these people. And it's a really touching film, and you know, I guess we'll probably get into some of the story behind the story with regards to this guy, Vigo, and this is his last film. He died at 29. From tuberculosis, and actually he never really got a final cut of the film, so there's that whole, you know, moving story behind
it. Yeah, and I had also read that not only was it his last film, it's also his first and only full-length film.
Right.
And during the filming, some days on set he was brought in on a stretcher because he wasn't strong enough to stand. Right. And you know, people would encourage him, like, look, go home. What are you doing? Like, slow down. And he said, I can't. I need to be here. Like, I can't slow down.
Well, I'm going to, I guess, be the lone dissenting voice. And it's not even a strong dissent because this is the first movie on the list I hadn't seen before. And so I realized that with you know, perhaps my next viewing, or if I choose to watch it several more times, I may come around on this. And indeed, as I was thinking about it, anticipating doing this podcast, I started realizing that there are some similarities to other films that I really do like. For instance, I started thinking about other love-hate dynamics that I enjoy, and there is a movie that came out in the same year called It Happened One Night. And I started thinking about it, and it sort of reminded me of It Happened One Night. And when I realized that there was a comparison to be drawn, I started to appreciate La Tolante a little bit more. So in that sense, this might be just my initial impression, but I had some trouble with the romantic element in that I didn't find myself rooting for the couple necessarily.
Why do you think that is?
So when It Happened One Night, it's about the courtship.
Yeah.
And initially, they don't super get along, or they don't always get along. And there's scenes of them arguing, and it's all very adorable. But there are also scenes of tenderness. And there's also a lot of sexual tension in It Happened One Night, the famous scene, shirtless Clark Gable. Whereas this, it sets up this dynamic where this couple that has already been married, like there isn't that burning tension. Like they get married, they fight, they make up, and that release is already done. So it's just like this cycle of seemingly to me abuse and reconciliation. Maybe abuse is too strong a word, but there did seem to be something sort of inappropriate in the way that he talked to her. I felt that I had a hard time getting past.
I think it's certainly a story about young love, and I think you're right. It doesn't showcase the courtship or anything like that. But in a way, I think it's sort of telling the tale of what happens when you do get married. And so the two young lovers, I thought there were a few scenes where they do show sexual tension, and it's sort of showcasing the kind of ups and downs of young love. And I thought it was good at getting across what it's like to actually be in love and to actually be living out the happily ever after in terms of learning how to deal with each other and learning how to meet in the middle.
Chris, how about you? What did you think of their relationship?
Well, it's funny. Your reaction was very similar to my wife, who saw it as a woman responding to this. She was really insulted, I guess, because the film has been lauded as this amazing film. And then here is like, well, you know, this guy's treating this woman like shit.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess you got to think of it in context of the times. With regards to them, the cat and mouse of them not seeing each other, I actually found that kind of interesting. I think like the film opens with these two walking out of a church, and you quickly realize that nobody approves of this marriage. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of apparent and unspoken that they don't really know each other. It's like she just wanted to get the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah.
She wanted to leave, and she wanted to see the world. And pretty quickly, she realizes all she's seeing is the inside of this boat.
Yeah.
In a grim world, it really looks like. I think one of the problems, or I guess it's, you can call it a subtlety to it, this guy, Jean, who, I mean, by the end of the film, he's not even the one that goes and saves her and finds her. It's the other guy,
right,
Paris,
yeah,
Jules, who,
yeah,
goes and finds her. I think there are two people with these needs, and you're not really sure what Jean's needs are, just the fact that he's got to keep his job and he's got to run this boat, and he certainly wants to do well by her, but she's obviously disappointed into the life that she's living on this boat. She just is desperate to get away and to see the world, and she's not able to do that.
But even then, when she goes off by herself, things don't really work out for her that well either.
Right.
And so I think you end up having both of them a little unsure and a little lost. But what becomes of them when they're apart, then I think you kind of realize that they need each other.
Yeah. I just always felt like this poor girl, she's trapped in her hometown. So she decides to marry this captain of a boat so she can go see the world. And ultimately, that doesn't work out. And then when she's finally emancipated, when she finally takes it upon herself to go out and do what she wants, she finds that the world is cold and empty and she doesn't like it. And so she returns back to the loving arms of her loving, maybe, arms of her husband. And it just seemed like that was a deeply unfeminist message that I felt troubled by. And I'm glad to hear that your wife also had a similar reaction, because this is such an important film. It is the number 12 greatest movie of all time. And I'm looking at it going, this is troubling for me.
What did you think that she should have found when she goes?
I mean, that is the question. Yeah, realistically, she goes off on her own with no money and nowhere to go and no job. She's probably going to encounter some hardship. And this is not the movie where the girl takes it upon herself to go find a job and find housing and go make a life for herself. I recognize this is not that movie. And it would have been probably dishonest to make it that movie. But somehow, I think the problem for me was that I didn't get a sense that she really loved her husband, only that she realized that the world was hard and cold and wasn't particularly interested in her happiness. And so it was sort of like a concession, like, I might as well go back to the boat and live with my husband rather than this grand romantic reunion.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I didn't feel that way. I thought that it was more focusing on the fact that relationships are hard, are difficult. And that was demonstrated by him doing stereotypical male things and her doing stereotypical female things. And then I thought that it was showing that relationships are difficult, but ultimately like worthwhile or important. This wasn't a light matter, the fact that they had gotten married. It wasn't some trivial thing that had happened. And then again, you know, like sort of showing what takes place after the honeymoon. He's not the great captain that she was looking for. And she is not the dutiful, passive woman that he was looking for.
Yeah.
And so then it's showing how they, you know, adapt to each other.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. Yeah, they're both ultimately have these expectations that weren't necessarily met, but they find that they need each other anyway.
And I think that it's sort of like, I'm not married, but I think it's sort of showing that married life is not easy, happy, like fun thing all the time, that it takes actual sacrifice.
It's war.
As the expert.
It's a battle to the death. War. On the mighty barge, right along. C'est tragique.
And I think one of the ways that I feel like he captured that, for me, one of the ways he captured that, the feeling of relationship struggling, was through the amazing cinematography. In the beginning, it's very clear almost immediately that no one is behind this marriage. There are a couple lines of dialogue somebody says, like, there's not even a party, there's not even a reception, you know? And then they're walking, and somebody else like mentions, like, hurry up, they're already almost to, you know, to the dock. And just in like the wide shots of them walking 20 to 30 paces in front of everyone, they're just out of there. They're just going.
Yeah.
And then they get on the barge, and there are a couple like really, really hauntingly beautiful shots of her dressed in white walking along the top of the barge that are just like incredible shots. And it was used so effectively to evoke the emotions in the audience.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's really not like I think one of the things that I think people later on love about the film is that it really goes against the grain of what were the movements at the time. If you think about It Happened One Night with Frank Capra, I mean, technically that was like the state of the art. It was just state of the art filmmaking. And here people complained about this film. It looked amateurish. That's why the new French New Wave guys loved it. You could just tell the guy just, you know, he created the blocking and all of that. But basically there wasn't any lighting. It was just like a guy with a camera just shooting this procession. There wasn't really much to it. And you could tell Vigo was like, it was the last thing that was really kind of on his mind with regards to that. He was more interested in just telling the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you seen Jules and Jim?
I saw it a long time ago.
I've seen it.
Okay. I'm not a fan of that film.
Not a fan? Oh, wow. Yeah. It's sort of some of the cinematography really reminded me of Jules and Jim, especially they both use a lot of fog. So I was reminded. Right. But yeah, so.
I've dated a few French women, so.
Yeah. You were forced to sit through it.
Prejudice.
Talk about how it depicted life aboard a barge. Did we feel like we got a sense of the claustrophobia, or what did it evoke?
Yeah, it didn't seem to like heavily emphasize that. Like there weren't a lot of montages of them working on the barge. It was just simply the backdrop. I'm reminded of one shot where Jules is playing cards. And the deckhand, the boy, is asleep behind him. And they're virtually on top of each other. And then to further emphasize that, there's a kitten on top of the boy's face, right. Like licking his face.
And speaking of the kittens, what did we make of the Pierre Jules character?
It was really interesting. I felt like there were so many layers that really unfolded throughout the course of the film, I thought.
Yeah.
You know, he started one way, just sort of silly as sort of a buffoon. Then he took like this dark turn where I feared that he was going to hit her or like hurt her.
Yeah.
Then they kind of become friends. And then there were some like heartwarming like humor. And then in the end it's he's the one that kind of puts the bow on the present, you know. He's the one that sort of rights their wrongs, yeah. You know, and brings them back together.
He's a hero. He's a really amazingly complex character. That scene in his room is just amazing.
Yeah,
these are all of the places that she would have loved to go, and he's kind of showing her all of these worlds, and then you see this like grotesque side of him. It's like not much is really made of it. It's like the cabinet goes away and you see these freaking severed hands in a jar. and she's just like shocked. She said, "What is this?" And he just said, "This is my friend." And it's like, "Why do you have these hands?" Like, "This is all I have left of him." And then just like, "I'm gonna leave it alone." Yeah. And then he takes his shirt off and then lights a cigarette and shoves it in his belly button with all these other tattoos. And then I feared for her as well. And then I felt safe with him. And then I started fearing for her again when she started playing with his hair and this whole thing was going on. So it was just an amazing scene. Like, I had no idea where this scene was going. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And we like the way we initially meet him is he's got kitty cats all over the place. Like, what's not to like? Of course, he's a sweetheart. And then he's mean to her, and then he takes her into his cabin, which is weird, and he's got severed hands, and he starts removing his clothing, and yet somehow at the end he comes out as the hero. So I'm still really not sure what to make of him. But
his character arc is sort of a demonstration of the couple needing to come together. He's showing her trinkets from all over the place, all these places that she would like to go. So in a metaphorical way, she does see all those places and all those things and experiences the danger of all the situations all through his character. Like, he's about to jump on her, then he's going to, you know, assault her. Then
yeah, that's really interesting. I think he does serve as sort of a metaphor for her attraction and fear of other places, of the unknown. I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting. Mm. Let's talk about some of our favorite scenes. I think obviously we touched on the cabin. Would that be, Chris, among your favorite scenes?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I do feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the underwater scene. I'm, of course, referring to the scene where Jean is missing Juliet, and it's a callback to one of the first scenes in the movie where Juliet dunks Jean's head into the bucket and says, "Can you see me?" And there's this whole story about how if you look underwater, you'll see the person you love. Towards the end of the movie, the lovers they're separated. And Jean, missing Juliet, jumps into the Seine. And there's this beautiful image of Juliet in her wedding gown. And I think that image is so evocative and still, and it feels so timeless, even though this movie was made in 1934. And I believe there have been several tributes to this scene in other films. And yeah, that one obviously still so beautiful.
I think it was kind of artsy fartsy.
It was a little artsy fartsy, yeah.
I thought it was artsy fartsy.
Fair enough.
In a particularly French way.
So one thing that kind of a thought that crossed my mind as I was watching this, I wonder if the French are as enchanted with themselves as we are of them. This movie struck me as so being so French, like with the accordions and the street, even the street peddler was adorable, and the bicycles and everything just feels so precious, kind of. did that strike you guys at all?
Well, the one thing that I would say, like in the beginning when she wants to go to Paris, like who wouldn't want to go see ladies wearing berets coyishly askew?
Yes, well.
So.
I mean, the cats seem French. The cats.
Exactly.
The cats
yeah, French. Very French. I don't know. I feel like I'm not French, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, you can't
speak
for them.
They're as infatuated. I mean.
But I think another really interesting thing about the film is that, you know, France and the rest of Europe at this time in 1934 was in the depths of the worst depression it's ever dealt with. Despotism was on the rise, and the rise of Hitler and his people, and Mussolini and all these guys. And all the most films that were coming out was like, we're in the money fantasies of let's just keep people happy and not have them think about their surroundings. And this film, no one in the film, you know, has any money. Everyone is poor and everybody's desperate trying to get by. And in the middle of all of this, there's this beautiful, like, love between them. Yeah, he was a mean guy, and he had done some things, but there was the scenes when they would cuddle together and they'd be together. There was just something so beautiful and sensual and very French, you know, about it. Yeah. I'm trying to tie the French thing
yes,
back
perfect.
Into that statement. I think I successfully did that.
I think nailed it.
Yeah, I absolutely.
It on.
It's not an easy thing to do because you're like, well, we want to make a real film, but all these things like lack of money, lack of nice things, lack of, you know, berets, you know, isn't ultimately not that important if you have love. It managed to tell an uplifting story, yet in a very realistic sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't sugarcoat love, but it was still a love story.
Yeah, and at the same time, with this realism, there's a kind of this carnival-esque atmosphere to the whole film. For some reason, it reminded me of a modern-day equivalent of Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Mm.
Just this crazy carnival-like atmosphere around these dingy and drab, yet kind of beautiful stories and places.
Mm. You know? So I think we can move on to the last question. Mm. Gabe, do you think it deserves its spot on the Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time list? The number 12 spot.
I think of all the films we've seen thus far, I think it deserves its place there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chris, how about you?
I don't want to be beholden to saying no. I mean, how can he say no? Sight and Sound and all these other people are saying yes. Like, for God's sake. No, I think it's drivel. I think it sucks. I think it definitely deserves to be on the list,
mm-hmm.
Whether it deserves to be at number 12. I don't know. Sight and Sound has, I think their opinions on things are slightly different than mine. I think there's definitely a bent and an angle. There's a European artsy angle. I think they kind of omit films, which I think should be included.
Yes.
But anyhow, I think it should definitely be number 12 on their list. I guess I'll put it that
well,
way.
Well, and that's... I feel like that's sort of what I meant. Of the 12 films on the list thus far, I believe it's in the mix.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
It deserves to be on said list.
Mm. Well, who can go against Sight and Sound? I'm going to tell you who. I can. Because, yes. I don't necessarily think it should be number 12. I agree it should be on the list. But considering It Happened One Night is nowhere to be found... And that's a film I prefer over La Tolande.
Nor It's a Wonderful Life.
Nor It's a Wonderful Life.
That's insane.
It's a Wonderful Life is not on the list. That is crazy. Well, Gabe, I think you got to do something about that, but that's for another day. But just after this discussion, I definitely feel like I have a greater appreciation for the film, but my objections still stand. And yeah, put It Happened One Night on there, for God's sakes. All right. Next up, we're going to talk about a contemporary movie for a change. This one comes courtesy of British filmmaker Stephen Knight, who wrote and directed the critically acclaimed recent release, Lock. As I mentioned, this is a recent release, and there are plot points that the filmmakers think should remain a surprise. Therefore, if you haven't seen the movie, put the earbuds down, go watch the movie, and come back to us. We'll just be here.
It's really a tough sell to tell our audience to stop listening.
I know, yeah.
We're trying so hard to get listeners, and now we tell them to stop listening.
No, it's all good. Just press pause, go watch the movie, turn us back on.
Okay.
All right. Did you guys all watch it?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, now that we're all on the same page, Locke tells the story of a man called Ivan Locke, played by Tom Hardy, who's driving from Birmingham to London to be by his mistress's side as she gives birth to their child. The trouble is, his mistress went into labor on the evening before the most important day of Locke's professional life. Oh yeah, and did I mention that his loving wife and family have no idea that his mistress exists, let alone that she's about to bring another little Locke into the world? The story is told in real time, as Locke makes a series of desperate calls to try to keep his meticulously assembled life from completely falling apart. Okay. Gabe, what'd you think?
I enjoyed it.
Okay.
And I thought it was neat. I thought it was engaging, and I liked it.
Okay. Chris, how about you?
I liked it a lot.
Okay.
Being a cameraman, director of photography, I just thought it was really neat that watching a film that they said was shot in 8 days, using three different cameras, just I loved how the film looks and didn't seem to bother me as a film goer. I didn't feel antsy being inside of that car for the hour and 25 minutes it took.
Yeah, I want to say you didn't notice.
Yeah, the movie clips along for sure.
I thought because the script is so tight and I'm just following along of like, what is going to happen with this guy? What's going to happen? And I loved how it's in real time.
Mm. Okay.
And you're looking at the most important hour and a half in a guy's life. And you're seeing all of it. And it wouldn't really resonate if it was a film that was about all of those events, but it was spread out over a day. I just feel like you wouldn't get, you know, they were making a point with it. And I thought it was really interesting.
Okay. Know? So you think they were making a point with it. So maybe you guys can clarify why this movie is so great, because I really, really thought it was not great. I really didn't like it. I thought that the message of the movie was muddy and ham-fisted, and I thought that the real time didn't serve it well at all. And my first impression, like even as I was watching it, I'm like, I bet this is totally the kind of movie that people may not necessarily see in theaters, but it's gonna like hit really big in Netflix, and like it's gonna be rediscovered by teenage boys, and they're gonna totally dig it. Teenage boys.
Maybe it was
really
a Ferrari.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, please, a hatchback.
Yeah.
You know, and I heard that BMW gave him the two cars to shoot with. And
that is not surprising. That logo was shut.
But like hatchbacks? Really? Well, they were like, that's like the only two cars they could spare?
He's a
like,
family man.
I guess.
So you thought you weren't crazy about the film?
I was not, no. And again, I think it was largely because their conceit was that we're going to make a movie that takes place within the span of an hour, and it's just going to be a series of conversations. And they built the movie on that premise more than they took a story and then folded in this idea into the story. So as a result, I felt like because of the structure of the movie, we got a lot of exposition. All of the characters kind of spewed exposition. And the structure of the movie necessitates that characters spew exposition. And I think one of the basic rules of storytelling is that you show, you don't tell. At least film storytelling. And this movie did a lot of telling, not a lot of showing.
It certainly was an issue that certainly was a gimmick they were using. I found it to be a good movie, but it is one of those that you kind of have to either accept that or reject it.
Right.
The only time that I felt that issue was when he's talking to his father. That was the only time when I felt the problem of him being in the car by himself. I didn't have an issue with the phone calls, really.
Okay. So I think this film is an exploration about what it means to be a good person. And that was my impression. You guys can tell me if you had a different impression. Do we think that this Locke is a good person? And do we think that the filmmakers feel he's a good person?
I think the character of Locke, I think, is very analogous to a tragic hero in like early Greek plays, which is a character that's basically good, but then has a tragic flaw or a fatal flaw or makes a tragic mistake. And so Locke, as is seen in many expository phone calls, Locke is a good businessman. He's a good family man, a loving father, dutiful husband. But then he's made this mistake that he's been unfaithful to his wife. And so the movie is showing him deal with the repercussions of this horrible mistake he's made. I really like how it's showing how, in this case, infidelity will uproot and destroy your life.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like the filmmakers are on the same wavelength, that this is a good guy that did something horrible, and this is what happens when you do something horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated the character at least attempting to make it right.
But you think, generally speaking, he's an upstanding guy. He's a good guy, virtuous.
I think so. I mean, and then I think in the conversations with his father, we see that he's certainly not 100% stable. And again, like I said, he's a character that's basically good and trying to do the right thing.
Okay, Chris, how about you?
I think he's a host of contradictions. I think the film itself is asking us a question. It's asking a philosophical question. Do you still stick to the truth if the truth will cause more harm than good?
Mm-hmm.
Here is this guy, and he is a fine, upstanding citizen. He's obviously great at his job. He believes in telling the truth, but he's also driven by this hatred of his father and who abandoned him. And his one goal in life is to not be like him. And I think that's what kind of fuels everything that he does. So that said, I think he does a bunch of shitty things in the film. You know, he cheats on his wife. He claims that it was a mistake. But he also knows the harm that's going to happen if, in fact, he does tell the truth. If he tells the truth, then his wife is going to be destroyed. If he tells the truth to his employers about why he's going, if he just lied, he would be able to kept his job. But more importantly, when he insists on keeping this job and trying to prepare it for the next day by having this kind of incompetent guy who's been drinking, he insists that this guy continues to prep this concrete pour. You know, he's putting his company, this guy, at risk. He's putting all of his superiors at risk. So he's doing what he wants to do based on his principles. Meanwhile, he's hurting all these other people.
Right. That was what really struck me, is he is compromising everyone else in the name of his own virtue. He really struck me as just being a self-righteous jerk. And I wasn't sure if the filmmakers felt that way or not. I felt like the filmmakers thought he was justified in all of his actions. I felt like that was the story that they were presenting us. But as I thought through it, I felt like he had every opportunity to do the right thing. First of all, he could have not had an affair. He could have had an affair and told his wife about it immediately. He could have told his wife about the pregnancy as soon as he found out about it.
Right.
But he does. It's not just.
And he wouldn't have been honest with her. She had this pregnancy early and he had to rush down and he had to give some excuse.
Right.
He probably wouldn't have told her.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. He would have continued to lie about it. That's how I felt. But
so what do you think changed in him that made him decide to stop lying about it?
Well, presumably it's his own sense of his self-righteousness. He takes pride in the fact that he is going to go and do the right thing because his father did not do the right thing. So he's going to go there and be there for her and uproot everyone else's life in the process and potentially destroy this groundbreaking piece of architectural or engineering history or whatever it is, this concrete pour that he's making such a big deal about. But I think he just has this really, like, horrible hero complex or hero syndrome. Even how he describes the affair, he was like, he felt sorry for her. So he's going to swoop in. He felt sorry for his secretary, so he sleeps with her. And now he's going to swoop in and be the hero. And that seems to be his MO. And he's not going to let some other contractor or site manager manage this big pour. He's going to do it himself over the phone.
Yeah, and I don't know, maybe as it all shook out, this wouldn't have been the case. And maybe I was too trusting of him at this point. But I thought it was made clear that it was going to be a disaster, that it would have been equally, if not more of a disaster, if they had brought in someone new at that point.
Well, that's so he says.
And that's fair. But I think to back that up was just how shocked and dismayed the company was that he was doing this. So I thought that was the case, that this was going horribly wrong no matter what.
You thought he thought that?
No, he thought that he was going to make the best of it. I got the impression that the best shot they had was the drunkard was talking to.
Yeah, I, now that I'm thinking, I tend to agree with you. Because there's so many little tiny loose ends about people to call and these things to make sure the road stayed open for the concrete and all that type of stuff.
Yeah, and even in talking to his boss and then talking to Donald, to the drunkard on site, there were a lot of mentions of the fact that Chicago would bring in some kid. And again, those, I think, were his words, but in the reaction of everyone else he was speaking to on the phone, that seemed to bear out, you know, that it wasn't going to be a good situation.
But one thing that was interesting about it, again, it's posing a question. You don't really know. I mean, like, how often do we walk through life really knowing exactly what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that was really fueling this guy was that he's just not going to repeat his father's sins. And I think that's the tragic deal about the film. This guy had spent his entire life not wanting to repeat the father's sins of his father, and he did it. And he did exactly what his father did. I'm not really sure what they're saying with that. I do think that the reason why he's doing this is because of this child, because he's going to make sure this child has a father. And at the end, the way fate turns out with this, he, in fact, most likely will end up being the active father because he just lost his family.
Yeah. So he abandoned one family for another. And it was interesting, the ending, I wanted to ask you guys, for me, I interpreted the ending as being positive in that the filmmakers felt he was doing the right thing by leaving his family and abandoning his job for this mistress and this other child. And that somehow all of his actions were vindicated because of this new life.
No, and I don't think that it vindicated all of his actions. I don't think the film is saying the ends... I mean, the film is not saying the ends justify the means, but it does end on a hopeful note when you hear the baby crying and he smiles.
Chris, what did you think about the ending?
I don't know. I guess the end is something... I didn't feel warm and fuzzy at the end of the film.
Circumstances get out of his control. And even earlier on, when he's first starting to make his excuses, I think to his son, it's not my choice. It's not my choice. It's out of my control. I'm not going to be there for the game. Mm. And at that point, he no longer had a choice. But like you said, he could have not slept with his secretary, and so he had a choice, but not anymore. And so the film sort of picks up with this character out of choices. And so then it's him trying to do the right thing or what he perceives to be the right thing in consequence of the fact that it's out of his control.
Well, I think he also had some sort of a a responsibility to, I guess you just kind of, it intimates that this woman is a very fragile woman who is could potentially be suicidal.
According to him.
And the doctors. That...
Well, you're awful bitter about this whole thing. You got this whole thing on this Tom Hardy character.
Well, I mean,
hell hath no fury, yeah. Like Pauline.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's borne out in the conversations with the nurses and doctors.
Mm, okay.
That she is not a stable woman, has no one to turn to.
That makes me like the film less, now that you mention it. That I don't like that they chose to make her unstable. I think that's a cowardly choice. But anyway.
What do you mean is a cowardly choice?
I think that it's unfair to have... I didn't like the way either of the female characters were portrayed in the film.
We don't see them.
We don't see them, exactly. But so the way... the portrayal and their voices. this is sort of my MO. To complain about how females are portrayed in movies. But...
You got a lot of truth in that, though, you know?
Yeah. But I felt like that was not a great choice to make the mistress unstable. And to somehow make it his sacrifice to sleep with her. And also the wife
That... I think you can chalk it up to, well, according to him.
Okay.
So that is when he's talking to his wife, trying to not necessarily lie, but trying to cushion the blow.
Right. But you were saying that it was supported by the nurses and the doctors that she was unstable.
That she was unstable at that point, like, you know, a woman about to give birth that has no friends or family.
But that does sort of support his suggestion that she is unstable and kind of pathetic. I didn't think it was a strong choice to make the secretary pathetic, though it does fit with his character in that he feels like he needs to be a savior to everyone, and it would make sense that he would be drawn to someone who is needy, who needs him.
I don't agree with that. I think it humanizes this child and these two people, because you sense that this woman, if she is abandoned, she really wouldn't be able to handle things. Mm. So I think it makes his moral dilemma deeper.
Yeah.
But he's still a self-righteous scumbag.
Yeah.
I'm reading Pauline's mind right now. Self-righteous scumbag.
And to be fair, to be clear, I'm not opposed to stories about self-righteous scumbags, as long as the filmmakers recognize that they're making a movie about a self-righteous scumbag. And I just didn't get that impression that the filmmakers felt he was a self-righteous scumbag. I felt like the filmmakers thought he was virtuous, and there was this disconnect for me. That's really where my issue was.
Yeah, and I don't know that, I mean, because you're pointing out all these things that happen in the film that make him a self-righteous scumbag, but those are the things that the filmmakers put in. So I don't know why you think that the filmmakers...
Well, they could be commenting. They could be more aware that Locke is a self-righteous scumbag, and we're displaying that scumbaggery for you here. You know,
like
they could be commenting on his hubris. Exactly.
Do you feel that he was making the wrong choice at that point?
At that point, I don't think he had a choice. But as you were saying, you mean the choice to go? Do I think he made the wrong choice to go to London? No. I think he made a series of bad choices leading up to that choice, which backed him into a corner, and he ultimately had to do this horrible thing and make that horrible phone call on the way to the hospital.
Well, the child came 2 months early.
Yeah, well, and at no point during the first 6 months of the pregnancy could he have mentioned to his wife, hey, so there's a baby on the way, it's mine. But another issue I had with the film, as I mentioned, is the structure of it. The real-time premise ensures that most of the dialogue is either going to have to be exposition or metaphor, which is where a lot of the themes that we're discussing comes from. And I was wondering what you guys thought about the metaphor of the pour, of the concrete.
You want to take that one? I was scratching my head at
nothing.
The concrete pour.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly.
Well, so in a lot of the dialogues with Donald, the drunkard who's handling things, I feel bad calling him a drunkard because he was the real hero
of
this
story. Four ciders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the real hero of this movie. Anyway, So as he's describing how important this pour is to Donald, he's talking about how, you know, we're going to carve out a piece of the sky and we're going to displace some air. He's talking about how important it is to have a strong foundation, and just one tiny crack could send the whole building down. I mean, it seemed like such an obvious metaphor. Like, do you think he's talking about himself? I don't know, guys.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I mean, sometimes obvious metaphors are okay. I mean,
yeah. So it didn't bother you that he spoke in metaphors, like that you felt like that served the story well?
I felt it served the character well, mm-hmm. in the respect that, you know, and his own wife said, you know, these little buildings of yours are more important than me. So the man was kind of an island unto himself, which I think really worked with the inside of the car, and he's alone in the car. So. I didn't mind the metaphor.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Fair enough. And even the one that really killed me was the one at the end when he's talking to his son, and the son is talking about the goalie and how he held on to the ball and didn't let it fly off into the crowd. Come on, give me a break.
I actually missed that one. Did you catch it?
A little bit. I think I caught that one. I thought that scene was like pretty emotional when he starts like breaking down. He's never going to see his son again. And, you know.
I guess I just rolled my eyes. Clearly, I have some emotional deficiency.
Well, I think I can't speak for you.
Yeah.
But I kind of vacillate between thinking that this film is kind of like the filmmakers want to pose questions and we answer them and they're not going to give you the answer. But I vacillate between that and like kind of their opinion of this guy is not my opinion. Like I agree with a lot of your opinions on this guy is putting this dude, Donald, like he's probably getting him fired.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For doing this stuff. He's causing all of this harm, yet we're supposed to be venerating him for his... How would you want to say?
His sacrifice. I mean, he's a noble...
His noble drive to be truthful.
Yeah, his vision. He reminded me... Let me know if this flies with you. As I was watching the movie, I was sort of reminded of The Fountainhead, the Ayn Rand novel. And maybe that didn't sit too well with me. It's about, like, human exceptionalism and specific humans and the great things they do. And it's about an architect, and it's about the buildings he builds and how great these buildings are and how it is, like the dialogue, the displacing of air, it seemed very Ayn Randian to me. But like this fixation on conquering nature and the certainty of like that they are correct against anyone else saying otherwise.
Oh, you think there's a libertarian bent from the filmmakers of this movie?
That's what I'm wondering. Huh. I don't know. I wasn't sure if they were critiquing this position or if they were reinforcing it. All right, so any final thoughts on the film, Gabe?
What are we going to talk about, John Locke?
Oh, yes. So why do we think they called the film Locke?
I think it is a reference to the philosopher John Locke, and in the film his name is Ivan Locke, and Ivan is a Slavic form of John.
Oh.
And John Locke was English philosopher from the 1600s, and John Locke was famous. Like his main philosophy was everyone is born as a clean slate. Everything you learn is from sense experience, and it's all about what you do or do not do. Mm-hmm. That's like the measure of the man. And so you had, I don't know if you'd say that Locke is striving to do that, or he is the embodiment of that, but he's always striving to do the right thing. So,
Good answer.
Wow, that was pretty deep research. That was amazing.
Chris, you got an answer?
Yeah, well, I didn't see it as John Locke, but I guess the name referred to a man who seemed locked and he was sealed to a fate to repeat his father's sins, no matter how hard he tried not to be him. He's locked inside of a car driving in one direction for the entire film. He's a man locked to his sense of right and wrong. and his integrity towards his family, his work, and the woman he got pregnant. He's locked in an unshakable hatred towards a father who abandoned him. He's a man who's locked to his own sense of things, and then everything else is crumbling around him.
I think those are both great answers, guys. Way to go. Okay, now that I've spent the last two segments bad-mouthing two very critically acclaimed movies, it's up for me to atone for putting negative thoughts into the world. To make up for it, let's end the show with a final note of positivity. Gabe, what's one thing that's been putting a smile on your face lately?
A short film called Moving On by Ansley Anderson. And I've probably completely butchered the name, but it's a stop-motion short film about moving on and life and death.
Interesting.
I just found it on the internet.
Okay.
And we'll share a link.
Awesome. Thank you, Gabe.
Thank you, Gabe. Well, I got what's really put a smile on my face recently is seeing that documentary Mortified. Have you guys seen it?
Mortified.
No.
Which one's that?
It's like what they call the Mortified movement. They have shows across the country.
Oh, okay. It's
basically people, adults, who read excerpts from their, like, seventh grade journals.
Oh, my God. What a nightmare.
It's really funny. I mean, it's really, really funny because everybody can relate that as a young adolescent, you feel just a whole – you're feeling things so much. You don't know you're half a child, you're half an adult, and you have ideas about things that are totally wrong. You have no idea who you are, you know what I mean? And it's a really, really funny movie if you get a chance to see it. And you could tell it's like this really cathartic experience for them.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
That sounds great.
It's called, it's called Mortified.
And I think that's on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, check that out. And we'll also link it in the show page. Mine is I've been watching a lot of a British television show called Peep Show, and it's delightful. I guess it's among the longest-running British comedy series on Channel 4 history. It stars David Mitchell and Robert Webb. They also do a show called That Mitchell and Webb Look, which is another sketch show. It's very funny. But Peep Show, it's about a couple of hapless idiots trying to make their way in the world, and the real hook of the show is that you get to hear all of their interior monologues, and a lot of it is shot from their perspective, which is very interesting when it comes to kissing shots. There's a lot of, like keeping their eyes open as they're kissing, which is creepy. But
I found that to be, like, a little too much.
Too much for you? You didn't dig it?
I didn't dig it. But I love that Mitchell and Webb.
Okay.
Those guys are so funny.
A lot of the humor in Peep Show is the contrast between what they say and what they're actually thinking. And it's just delightful. It's really bawdy, but if you dig that sort of thing, which apparently I do. Also, if you enjoy shows where everything works out at the end, this might not be the one for you. But if you enjoy shows that will make you feel better about your own life, then by all means, check out Peep Show. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Let us know what you think of La Tolante and Locke on our show page, flickswise.com. You can also come talk to us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. We're also on Twitter at flickswise. And just so we've got all of our bases covered, we're also on Tumblr. Make sure to tune in next time for another entry into the Flickswise alternate greatest of all time list. This time, Chris is going to submit William Friedkin's 1973 film, The Exorcist. Until then, Chris and Gabe, thank you so much, guys.
Anchors away.
Full steam ahead, fellas.
Choo-choo. I don't know.
Yay.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. Au revoir.